at info@wpfw.org.
The best in live music entertainment is coming this spring to Bethesda Theater. Let's welcome music royalty, The Whispers, performing all their classic songs for two big shows on Friday, April 26th at 8:30 p.m. and again on Saturday, April 27th at 8 p.m. Also coming is Trouble Funk, featuring go-go legend Big Tony, celebrating his birthday by performing all their go-go classics on Friday, May 3rd at 9 p.m. And on Mother's Day, it's Howard Hewitt performing his own popular songs and those by Shalimar for two shows on Sunday, May 12th at 3 p.m. and 7 p.m. The Whispers on April 26th and 27th, Trouble Funk featuring Big Tony on May 3rd, and Howard Hewitt on Mother's Day, May 12th. Get more information on all shows at BethesdaTheater.com. WPFW is a proud media partner with Bethesda Theater.
No social justice issue or movement can escape the spotlight of the Latino Media Collective. The Latino Media Collective delivers consequential coverage from the biggest countries in South America to the smallest enclaves of Central America and the Caribbean, and is available on SoundCloud, iTunes Podcast, and Google Play Music. The Latino Media Collective is recorded in WPFW studios and airs Fridays at 1 p.m. on WPFW, Washington.
Yep, Miller. My guest today is Nick Tabor. Nick Tabor is the author of Africa Town, America's Last Slave Ship, and the Community It Created. He's also a freelance journalist who has written for The New Republic, The Paris Review, and The Washington Post. How are you doing today, Nick?
Doing fine. Thanks for having me.
Good. You know, Nick, let's begin by first talking about Mobile, Alabama. Mobile, Alabama in the early 1860s. What type of city is it? How did the production of cotton in this city affect the economy of the South as well as the North?
Well, it was a massive city. The first thing I'd like to say about it, it was the third largest port city in the United States in the years right before the Civil War. After New York and New Orleans, it was a port city, as it still is, and a great deal of cotton produced elsewhere in the state of Alabama was being channeled through Mobile. So it was quite an international city. Vendors, people came from all over the world to buy Mobile's cotton and bring it back to Europe and other continents. And as of 1860, on the eve of the war, there was a great shortage of labor. It was no longer legal to import slaves from West Africa. You could only buy them from within the United States. And there was just so much demand for cotton. The price of cotton was so high that they just couldn't get enough enslaved people to help process it all. Some of the hotels, in fact, were resorting to using the labor of Irish people. And we have travel logs from Mobile in those years when, guests from other parts of the South stayed at these hotels and were a little bit uncomfortable about being waited on by people whose skin was white.
That's interesting. And also, how did this production of cotton affect the development of the North?
This was the main export of the United States in those years, and it was just as, I think it was roughly as valuable as a commodity throughout the world as oil is now for countries like Venezuela and the countries in the Persian Gulf. So it was, a lot of northern banks had a lot of investment in the cotton industry. For that matter, even in the UK, there was a sense of investment in the southern cotton trade because the textile mills all depended on cotton. Mm-hmm. So the South was really the driver of the whole United States economy.
All right. Well, Nick Tabor, take us back to 2018. Talk about a phone conversation you have with an editor that will result years later with the publication of Africa Town in 2023.
Mm-hmm. I was working at New York Magazine at the time, and my editor called me into her office one morning and said, she said, look, there's this book coming out called Barracoon. It was written by Zora Neale Hurston back in the late 1920s. But it was never published. For a long time, it had been at Howard University, in fact. I've held the original manuscript. She said, it's about to be published, finally. And it consists of Hurston's interviews with Kodjo Lewis, who was one of the last survivors of the last slave voyage that ever came to the U.S. And she said, so we're going to be publishing an excerpt of it in the magazine, and it would be really nice if we could also publish a story alongside it about what became of the descendants of Kodjo Lewis. And that seemed like a great idea. It turned out to be more difficult to execute than I think either of us planned. The descendants of Kodjo had not really made themselves known to the world, but after a lot of digging and some help from a genealogist who I found had a little contact with the family, I did get one of Kodjo's descendants on the phone. I happened to be in West Texas working on another story when I spoke with him, and I remember he said, his name is Gary Lumbers, and he lives in Delaware now. At the time, he was living near Philly. I remember he said pretty forcefully, you don't need to be writing about the descendants. What you ought to do is write about the neighborhood, which his the portion of Africatown where he grew up was called Plateau. He said, when I was a kid, it was this wonderful community. Everybody had a big family. Every lot had a house on it. There were good jobs. There was a small business district with all these independently owned businesses, black-owned businesses. He said, now, if you visit there, it looks like a war zone. There's lots of factory pollution. Many of the lots are empty. The population is a fraction of what it used to be. And he said, what did they do to it? This was not just a normal process of erosion. It was like, this was product of choices that people made. So I visited there later in the week. And I happened to be there on a day when a law firm was interviewing people about, cancer cases in their families. This firm was suing a paper mill that had operated near the neighborhood for many years, and the firm was saying that all the pollution from the paper mill had caused hundreds or thousands of cancer cases. And so I spoke with a bunch of people myself who just went through lists of all the family members of theirs who had died, often at young ages, from cancer, and these stories were just horrifying. And so when I went back to New York, it really stuck with me, and I kept thinking, you know, it cannot be a coincidence that this community, which was, I should say, that the community that we're talking about, where Gary Lumbers grew up, is the community founded by the people who were on this last slave ship. And I thought, it can't be a coincidence. Mm-hmm. That the community founded by the survivors of that voyage also became designated as the dumping ground for heavy industry in southern Alabama. So what is that connection? Like, how did that neighborhood get set aside for this? And I kept thinking, I wish I could just move down there and you know, fit all the pieces together.
Because Nick Tabor, I looked at some of the things that you wrote, you know, as a freelance writer, and I don't want to put a label on you, but it seems as if you're not just a freelance journalist. You seem to be an investigative journalist.
I would say that I'm an investigative journalist, yeah.
And how did those skills, you know, help you in terms of doing your research, doing your interviews? It seems like you're trying to solve a case, not just write a story.
Yeah. I think that's true. It's like an anthropological case, but it's still it felt like solving a mystery. There are stories in history that journalists are actually better suited to write about than academics, or at least we can bring something different. I should say I depended a lot on the work of academic historians, and I would never want to slight them. You know, without the work that they had done before me, I'm not sure this would have been possible. Mm. But there are cases where a journalist will, you know, might be able to get a hold of a document or get somebody to speak because of our, you know, the skills that we've spent years cultivating, more so than an academic historian might.
Well, you know, there's an added thing, Nick, also, is that when someone, and I encourage my listeners to pick up Africatown, it's the writing itself. You know, what happens is that, you know, you pick up your book and you keep reading it because of the style. You know, I know you could take a history class and then say, okay, I'll read chapter one and put that down because it's, you know, it's just facts. It's not, you know, you're telling a very good story. And I want to lead into two individuals I want you to talk about briefly because they play a key role in the story of Africatown. Talk about Timothy Meyer and William Foster.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Timothy Meyer was a businessman who lived in southern Alabama. He came from an Irish Catholic family in Maine. And, you know, in the years, something I realized when I was researching this is that in the years after the Louisiana Purchase, that part of the Deep South was sort of like the America's frontier for a little while. And so it was, I think it seemed like quite a glamorous thing for a young man in the Northeast to move down there. And in Mayer's case, to become a riverboat captain. So he kind of worked his way up, working on different ships, worked his way up the hierarchy, and saved his money as he went. And by the late 1850s, by the time that the Civil War broke out, he had amassed a pretty large empire for himself as an independent businessman. He had a lumber yard, he had a sawmill, he had a shipyard. And he was also, in some ways, pretty active in politics. He was part of this push to reopen the transatlantic slave trade. A number of Southern businessmen wanted to do this because, again, they needed the labor of the enslaved people. So he's the one who arranged to send the ship over to West Africa. We think that he did it as a sort of a political protest to show the federal government, to sort of call its bluff and say, yeah, I know this is illegal, but you're not going to prosecute me for it. Mm-hmm. And he wanted the word to get out that he was getting away with this. So he hired this captain named William Foster. I think he went by Bill Foster, who was from Nova Scotia. And Foster was a ship captain. He built this ship called the Clotilda that was like the perfect vessel for this voyage. I mean, in the last couple of years, we have started to believe that this ship might have been built for illegal slave voyages, not to go all the way to West Africa, but to bring people from like Cuba up to ports along the Gulf Coast. It was a fast ship. It had a huge hold, like a lot of space, enough space to hold more than 100 captives. And so Bill Foster became the one who ended up taking it all the way across the Atlantic Ocean and bringing back this cargo of slaves.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know, you mentioned 1927, Joan Neal Hurston. We'll bring her into the picture. She will travel to Plateau, Alabama, and she'll talk to Kojo Lewis, who at that time I think was 86 years old. Mm-hmm. What I find interesting, I wonder whether it showed up in your research. Langston Hughes meets Zora Neale Hurston at, I think, a train station in Mobile, Alabama in 1927. They traveled together. And I was wondering whether there's any conversation about Barracoon between Langston Hughes and Zora Neale Hurston.
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, it's hard for me to imagine that they wouldn't have talked about it on the road. You know, we don't have those conversations recorded. I guess what we do have, the one recorded piece of the one recorded exchange we have is in a letter that Hurston wrote to Langston Hughes, where she says, you can tell from the letter that Langston knows all about Cudjoe. And Zora says, I found another person who was on that slave voyage up near Selma. Her name is Radoshi, and she says she actually said she's a better talker than Kajo, but for some reason Hurston didn't want to bring her into the story or didn't want to focus on her. She actually said to Langston, "No one will ever know about her but us."
Okay, now let's hold that point. I know that story too, Nick. That's why I'm glad you retold it. Okay, let's hold that point, right? Now, let's look at, and I know you've talked about this in some other interviews. You talk about Carter G. Woodson helping Zora Neale Hurston. He'll publish like an excerpt of what the interview that she does with Kojo Lewis in a Journal of Negro History that he was editing. Okay, but we also know that here we have a lot of claims of plagiarism. Talk about that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she. So I think that the first time Hurston went down, we have to remember she was still an undergraduate student. She was pretty young. She was studying at Barnard College, the women's
but
college.
She was older than Langston Hughes.
She was, yeah. She went to college late, and she had she's a mischievous character. I love her, of course, but she had a tendency to lie about her age. We didn't know how old. We didn't even know when she was born until somewhat recently.
Okay, hold that point, right? Yeah, now, you are an investigative journalist, right? Which you just admitted on the air. Are you really suspicious of some of the stuff that she's putting together now?
I have to say, you know, I feel a little bit uncomfortable as being a white journalist about about interrogating the genius, you know, the genius writer Zora Neale Hurston, a black woman. But I do try to treat everything with a similar degree of.
Okay, I'm gonna pardon you on the ear, Nick. but go ahead.
Okay, yeah. So and I'm not the one who figured out when she was born. I believe that her biographer Valerie Boyd is the one who figured that out. But it could have been a different biographer. So Hurston went to Alabama in 1927. She had a commission to interview Kajo. She was part of the Harlem Renaissance, and there was a desire in the Harlem Renaissance to collect the stories of people who had been enslaved while they were still around. So she seems to have had a difficult time getting much information out of him. He did have a thick accent from West Africa. And even for somebody who was from the South, like her, I think it was difficult to understand him. So what she did is copy quite a bit of material from a book that had been written about 12 to 14 years earlier by a woman who lived in Mobile named Emma Langdon Roche. Emma Langdon Roche had spent quite a bit of time. She was a white woman, but she'd spent quite a bit of time in this community and gotten to know the survivors of the slave voyage. So Hurston copied some material from her verbatim and sent it to Carter G. Woodson. And Carter G. Woodson put her article in the Journal of Negro History. And her biographers have wondered, what was she thinking? You know, like why did she take such a big risk? She could have gotten into so much trouble. And we're not even sure that she knew it was going to be published. There's a chance that she thought it was just for Woodson's files. But she ended up going back to, it was never found out. She ended up going back to Mobile the following year and spending a lot more time around Kajo. And she did get a lot more out of him the second time. And for the most part, the plagiarism is not there in the longer manuscript that she wrote.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have a copy of Barracoons, and this came out in 2018. And Alice Walker wrote the foreword. I just want to read a few sentences here. Alice Walker writes, "Reading Barracoon, one understands immediately the problem many black people years ago, especially black intellectuals and political leaders, had with it. It resolutely records the atrocities of African peoples inflicted on each other long before shackled African traumatized it. Disoriented star arrives on ships as black cargo in the hellish West." You know, one of the things I found very interesting, Nick Tabor, is that the Africans who capture Khosla, Khuja Lewis, are actually the Africans that we see highlighted with Viola Davis in The Women King.
Yes, that's correct. The Kingdom of Dahomey.
Right. Talk about that.
Yeah, they, I mean, as I've been making, doing author events lately, people have been asking me about, you know, these African warriors who captured and sold their own people. And I always remind them, like, yes, they lived on the same continent. They had the same skin color. But if you had asked a, you know, a French person at that time, whether somebody from, I don't know, Romania were, if those were their own people, I think they would have said no. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that they had this understanding in West Africa either. We are talking about different ethnic groups with, you know, different histories, different languages. So the Kingdom of Dahomey was a heavily militarized state. The driver of its economy was this trade in enslaved people. There was, in fact, an effort to convert the economy to using palm oil as the main export, but it didn't really go over so well. We think that some of the advisors of the king plotted to overthrow him because he was trying to do away with the slave trade. And so this king's son took over, and in the years right before the Clotilda voyage, he was carrying on the slave raids with a vengeance. He was kind of making a show of being this warrior king. And so he had this large group of very fierce women warriors, who European visitors always called them the Amazons. They were highly trained, they were very strong, and they were fierce in battle. And so they ended up raiding this village that Khuja Lewis and many of the other shipmates came from, executing most of the elderly people, because they would not have been able to sell them to Europeans as slaves, and hauling away the younger people. They brought them to a big port city called Ouidah, and that's where they sold them.
You know, I found something interesting based on the story that Khuja Lewis tells in terms of in Barracoon, in terms of these women warriors. He describes what they look like in their dress and stuff. And when I read it, I said, this is interesting. Because in the film, The Women King, if I was to look at Barracoon, the warriors are pretty much out of, like, what kind of the Black Panther with the bald heads.
Uh-huh.
You know, as opposed to, you know, I mean, you know, yeah. Maybe Viola Davis didn't want to shave her head, but what I'm saying is, right. Very interesting in terms of, we have documents that if we're a filmmaker, we say, okay, we have an eyewitness account. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what Khuja experienced in terms of his captivity in Barracoon. Could you share that with our listeners?
Yeah, I would be happy to. I mean, there was his captivity in West Africa, which did not last very long. He was being sort of marched from his town all the way down to the coast. That was, of course, just an utterly horrifying experience. His family members had been beheaded, some of them, and the Dahomean warriors were actually carrying the skulls with them. Then he was on this ship for 6 to 7 weeks. Not getting enough to eat, the sea was roiling, people were throwing up all over. He was chained to the bottom of the ship, and then he was in. He was enslaved in the United States for 5 years during the Civil War, and he spent a lot of that time on a boat going up and down the Alabama River, the Mobile River, where he was helping with the cotton trade. Working on behalf of the person, Timothy Mayer, who had brought him over.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, before we get have our break, Nick Tabor, I want to mention what I find interesting about your book, and it has to do with terms of, I guess, the publisher's decision, okay? We're talking about Africatown. The title of your book is Africatown, America's Last Slave Ship and the Community It Created. okay? If I'm in a bookstore, I just see the, you know, the boat on the top and what I guess is like Mobile, Alabama. But as soon as I pick up your book in the beginning, you say, this is a book about environmental racism.
Yeah.
And I was wondering why that doesn't come out in terms of the cover design or even with the subtitle.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think that the we went through a couple of different possibilities for covers. This is a one of them did and try a little bit more to depict that. But there are so many layers of this story. It was I'm not sure how we could have gotten across like the slave voyage, this proud community of Africatown. That has a rich story, even apart from the environmental racism, the story of defiance and struggle, and also all the pollution from the factory. So we tried to fit in as much as we could.
Yeah, but Nick, you did an excellent job, or your company did an excellent job in the breaking down your manuscript into four sections.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can basically say, I mean, you know, if I want to go and talk about, you know, what it was like in the 1950s to 2008, I can go straight to that section. And so mm-hmm. I'm just wondering in terms of which section is going to dominate in terms of the telling of this overall story. And it seems as if we're dealing with maybe part one and not part four.
Right. I mean, I think the part one is the most, novelistic. It deals with events in kind of a moment by moment way, and then in the later sections I do have to cover sometimes a couple of decades at a time. But my hope is that people will get something out of all four sections, I guess.
Okay. Let me be tough on you, Nick. Okay.
Yeah.
Looking at the type of work you do, and I made reference to the type of articles that you've written, and we talked about being investigative journalism. It seems that if you write this book, which took some time of your life because you're writing a book, you probably would say, okay, I really would like to affect public policy. I really like to, you know, make sure that laws dealing with the environment are perhaps passed in say Mobile, Alabama.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just putting on. Wouldn't you want to see your work being used that way?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. I mean, in a way, on one level, a journalist, you know, like a journalist is just trying to tell the story, and we have a sense that you know, making laws is not really our job. Like, people will use the information however they will. But of course, I mean, I wrote this from a sense that I was seeing injustice in the world, that I wanted to do my part to bring it to light and ultimately see it corrected.
Okay, now I'm going to ask you a Paul Wellstone, Robert Kennedy type of question. You know, you mm-hmm. you travel south, you know, go down to Mississippi, whatever, or go down to Alabama. How does what you see and what you write, how does it change you, you know, Nick Tabor?
Oh, wow. I mean, these people that I got to know in Africatown, I think they're going to be my friends for life now. I've just been so profoundly affected by the story. In fact, I did an author event last night where I was talking about this passage where the community in the 1980s, the community was protesting the construction of an industrial warehouse in their neighborhood. And, I couldn't help but choke up a little bit as I was reading it. Like many journalists, I've always had a strong sense of justice and injustice, I guess. But it's only been intensified by all this research I've done, and I think I feel more attuned to it than ever to the plight of poor Black communities like this one.
Mm. Is there anything that you see in terms of, you know, finishing a book like Africatown that you say, you know, I came across some information in my research, you know, like Leeds, for example. I want to go back and examine that, maybe get a book contract or find a magazine that would be interested in another article. So it's like, do you find something in your research for Africatown that says, okay, there's another story here that's been hidden?
I have done some of those, yeah. I'm working on one. I did another recently. Some of your readers may have seen this piece that I had in the Washington Post in January about, in February, about this group called the Afro-American Bicentennial Corporation. It was founded by two brothers, Robert and Vincent DeForest, in the early 70s. The bicentennial celebrations for the United States were coming up in 1976, and these brothers said, look, if we don't, you know, if we and other people from the civil rights movement don't get involved, then they're just going to ignore Black history completely. So the DeForest brothers started this group out of their basement, out of Vince's basement, and they were pretty successful in one area in particular that was getting Black history sites added to the National Register of Historic Places and the National Landmarks Program. And within a few years, they were able to sort of strong-arm the federal government into adding, like, scores of Black history sites. It went from three up to something like 85 in a few years, pretty much all thanks to these brothers and to all of the scholars and the scholars and Black policymakers that they were able to bring together. So their story plays into the Africatown story a little bit.
Okay. Nick Tabor, we're going to take a little break. My guest this morning is Nick Tabor. He's the author of Africatown, America's Last Slave Ship and Community It Created. The show's on the margin. My name is Ethelbert Miller. The station is WPFW 89.3 FM. On the margin with Nick Tabor, the author of Africatown, America's Last Slave Ship and the Community It Created. Nick, let's talk about the creation of Africatown. Talk about how one creates a community after slavery and the importance of what you write about the need for the access of land.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the survivors of this voyage, a few dozen of them were still in Mobile County. And the first thing they wanted was to go back to West Africa. You know, they had lived there for their whole lives and only been here for about 5 years. But they had no way of getting back. So their second resort was to try to obtain some land. And they asked Timothy Mayer, the guy who brought them over, if he would give them some land, because he had a lot. And they figured that he owed them, which, he obviously did. But he refused. So they saved what they could and purchased some land from him, and they pooled their wages, and then they helped each other build houses. And
let's bring something else in there.
Yeah.
I'm gonna bring you back in your own book. Before you get that, talk about Sherman coming through the South.
Oh yeah, of course. Yeah, he was when he was making that march toward the coast. He convened a group of Black leaders in Georgia, and he asked them what they wanted, basically. after he had liberated them, he asked them to sort of come up with a proposal for how the Union Army could help them, and they came back and said, what we really want is land. And they didn't even say we want it to be given to us, even though they would have been well within their rights to ask for that. They said, we want to be put on land for long enough to use it to earn money so that we can then buy it. We want to earn it.
So this was almost the beginning of the 40 acres, actually.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So word began to spread that there were going to be 40 acre plots given to emancipated people. And Sherman said the Union Army could also lend them mules so they could plow. And so that's how this idea of 40 acres and a mule sort of took hold.
Mm. I wanted to bring that in because I think that's very important. But let's get back to the actual what happens in terms of Africatown, in terms of how did it get access. Well, let me ask you this. Mm-hmm. We talk about Mobile, then you talk about Plateau, then we talk about Africatown. Break down the geography. Is this like, you know, I'm here in D.C. Is this like Silver Spring and Bethesda? You know what I mean? This exactly. You know, when we talk about Mobile and we talk about Plateau, Alabama, and then, Africatown, talk about the actual location.
Yeah, I will say there are some maps in the book to make things easier on readers. If you flip it open, within the first couple pages, you'll see some maps that lay it all out, and there are some photographs. Mobile, there's Mobile County and there's the city of Mobile. In the land that these shipmates bought during Reconstruction, during the late 1860s, was north of the city of Mobile. It was separated from the city by a swamp, and it was land that nobody really wanted. There was already some heavy industry out in that area, some sawmills, but not much in the way of civilization. And it was, remote enough that it was a place where they could sort of be left alone. So they established this little settlement. It really was very small, that became to be called African Town. And over time, that name sort of fell away. A lot of people who are living now, who are up there in years, will say that when they were kids, the name Africa Town was not used. There was a part of it called Plateau. There was a part of it called Magazine Point. Some other neighborhoods, and then in the 70s and 80s, a neighborhood activist said, "We got to bring back the name Africa Town." He shortened it from African Town to just one word, Africa Town. And he said, "This will, we need to think of this as an identity for all of these little neighborhoods that are conjoined here. Like, this is our collective identity. Like, we have the heritage of having been established by the people who were on that ship, and we should advocate for our political interests, all together on that basis." So Africa Town includes Plateau, Magazine Point, and some other communities. And it's now part of the city limits of Mobile.
How active, we talk about the importance of land in terms of these new residents for Africa Town. How much did they become interested in obtaining the right to vote and political power?
They registered to vote. They became citizens and registered to vote in 1868, so about as early as they were able to. And we have this amazing story about them voting in 1872. There was a big push throughout Alabama anyway, in that election to stop black people from voting. These were sort of the late days of Reconstruction. The federal government was not quite as active in the South as it had been right after the war. And the Southern, at the time, they were actually the Democrats. That was the party of the people who would, who would owned slaves. They were saying, these black people are going to try to steal the election. Like, they're going to commit fraud. So we got to stop them. And it was just a cynical way of preventing them from exercising their rights. But Timothy Mayer himself, the guy who brought the slaves over, he tried to stop these members of the community from casting ballots three times. He beat them to different polling locations and told the clerks not to let them cast ballots. So in this very stirring moment that's been recorded, the three of them clasped hands together and prayed that God would let them vote. And then they walked all the way to the city and paid the poll tax. It was a lot of money for them, and cast ballots and for the Republican Party, which again was the sort of the abolitionist party. And they were so proud of it, they held on to their voting receipts for the rest of their lives.
Well, let's fast forward and go from the 1860s, go from the Reconstruction, and come up into the 1950s, late 1940s, 1950s. How is Africa Town affected by the civil rights movement now?
A lot of people in Mobile like to say that things were very different in Mobile than they were in Montgomery and Birmingham. They like to say, it was all peaceful here. Black and white people just settled their differences amicably. and there was no violence or very little violence.
Nick, we're talking about the home of Hank Aaron and Satchel Paige.
Yep. There's an idea that there's a rumor that I think is probably not true, that Martin Luther King came to Mobile. There are variations of it, but I think in most versions, like, he comes to the airport and the black leaders in Mobile meet him there and say, don't come here because it's just going to stir up conflict and we can take care of this ourselves. Mm-hmm. Again, we don't think that actually happened. And my friend, I have a friend named Scotty Kirkland. In fact, he and I are appearing together tonight in Montgomery at a bookstore. Scotty has been working on a book about Mobile in the civil rights era, and he shows that, in fact, there was a lot of violence in those years in Mobile. And there were many, many house bombings and other acts of violence that have sort of been papered over in the popular version. But that stuff did not, most of that stuff happened within the city limits, and Africatown was not necessarily this is around the same time that Africatown came into the city, but it was somewhat removed from the marches and the protests that were happening downtown.
Well, let's talk about two things, and we're moving towards the end of our show, Nick Tabor. Let's talk about the 50s and 60s and bring it up to the present, where we're talking about the impact of air pollution from the paper mills. We're talking about now highways being built through Africatown. Talk about how the community responds to these things.
Yeah. Well, for a long time, the community accepted the pollution. To some degree, it did. For one thing, people just didn't know as much back then about environmental health. We didn't really know how pollution affected our bodies. Of course, they didn't like it, but they were just trying to survive. They had other more pressing concerns and other more, you know, imminent problems, I guess, than air pollution. So they would, like, when ash from the paper mills rained down on the neighborhood, they would just rush to get the clothes off of the line. All the kids, you know, knew that they had to run back home and help their mothers with that. They lobbied one of the paper mills to set up a car wash, because they found that this ash from the mills, if it got onto their cars, it would like eat away at the bodies of their cars. One of the paper mills set up this car wash that anybody in Africatown could use. You didn't have to work at the mill. The jobs were good. These were unionized jobs. They paid pretty good wages, and they allowed people to raise their families. And so for a long time, they kind of accepted this as a necessary evil. But over time, they did start to mobilize and protest, like, the expansion of factories in their neighborhood, and they've had more and more success as time has gone on. In 2012 and 13, they successfully fought back a plan to build a bunch more petroleum tanks and set them on the edge of the neighborhood.
Well, let's also talk, as we come to the end, about some of the ongoing things in terms of trying to find the Clotilda, also the area trying to build a monument to Africatown and make it tour, I guess, like a tourist attraction. Talk about the things that are going on now.
Uh-huh. Well, a few years ago, in 2018 and 19, some archaeologists made this extensive survey of all of these shipwrecks in the Mobile Delta. This area was once a ship graveyard where captains would take old ships that they didn't want anymore and just sink them there like a salvage yard. And they were pretty sure the Clotilda was one of these. And so they cataloged the remains of all of those ships and matched them to records in the National Archives. And they pinpointed which one was the Clotilda. So that could be a huge attraction. They're probably not going to raise it. That question is unsettled, but it it would be very difficult and costly to do, and there's a danger that it would all just fall apart if they tried to bring it out of the river. So we'll see how that goes. It's more likely, I think, that there are going to be boat tours that take people out to the site of the wreck. There's also a museum that's going to be opening in July in Africatown called the Heritage House, and it will have some artifacts from the ship. And the hope is that this will, that this will bring people from all over the place, and sort of a pilgrimage, as we call it, heritage tourism. And that it will also bring some economic revival to the neighborhood and create jobs for people living there.
You know, when you mentioned that, you know, I'm thinking about some of the nearby states in terms of, I'm thinking like Mississippi, where people want to do things on the local level, but there's opposition on the state level. So I was wondering, when we look at Africatown, if we would look at the state legislature of Alabama, is there a concern, is there an interest in terms of revitalizing this area and helping, or is it an opposition on the state level?
There is interest. I would have to say that, on balance, the state in the last few years has done a pretty good job. The Alabama Historical Commission, you know, which is different from the legislature, it's non-political. They especially have done right by this community. If you ask people in Africatown where the struggle is or where they're facing opposition from, I think more of them would say it's the city of Mobile. This is a contentious issue, but the city of Mobile, on one hand, I think does, you know, want to support this, but on the other hand, depends heavily on the petrochemical industry for its economy. And it sort of wants to have things both ways, I think, to be a hub for the petroleum industry and to be a place like Charleston or Savannah that depends on tourism and the service industry for its economy. And they would like to think that you can have it both ways. But the thing is that you only have one waterfront. And if you give that over to heavy industry, then people aren't going to be able to, you know, you're not going to have a boardwalk there.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask something about a weather question. Because of the location, over the last, say, 5 or 6 years, has Mobile been affected by storms and hurricanes?
It has. Yeah, I lived through my first hurricane when I was living in Mobile a couple of years ago, and it's really not very far from the site where that BP oil spill happened. If you map it out, it's really very close. With all of these petroleum tanks sitting right there on the water, a lot of people do worry that it's a disaster waiting to happen.
Well, I raise that because if you're going to be building museums and things of that sort, I'm concerned about, you know, the artifacts. I mean, who would want to donate something if it's going to be, you know, not in a, you know, in terms of an alleyway where hurricanes are hitting, you know?
Sure.
That would be a concern in terms of just protection. And then I also know that, for example, in cities like New Orleans, sometimes the destruction to the actual environment is responsible for the storms being more severe.
Uh-huh, right. Yeah, well, I mean, I think better artifacts in museums than petroleum tanks that could potentially spill oil into the community.
I love your logic, Nick.
Yeah.
We're going to have you come into Washington to testify and use those type of reasons.
Yeah, just tell me when.
Right. Well, you know, I was wondering, you know, because of the visibility that you've given, you know, to Africatown, whether when people are getting together, will you be assisting them in terms of any type of fundraising and things of that sort, or promoting your book to bring more attention to this part of our country and our history?
Yeah, I happen to be in Mobile right now on a short book tour. So I just appeared the last two nights. I did events with members of the community where we talked about the history, but also what they need now in the present day, and I feel like this is going to be a permanent relationship for me, and I, you know, I'm always going to be doing whatever I can to help them advance their goals.
What has been the criticism? Any criticism that people would say, well, Nick, you, I like your book, but you were wrong on page 155 or something like that? Is it people been picking at your research or anything?
They haven't really been. I mean, I let me think. There, of course, there are different ways that I could have, directions I could have taken this. And, you know, some of the descendants, I think, do wish that it had, the book focused more on the descendant community, rather than the neighborhood and the environment. And, to that, I would say, you know, it's of course, like telling more stories about the descendants is very worth doing. But the focus of my book is the environment, and that's just that's just the way it was going to be from the beginning. But my feeling is, you know, let a thousand flowers blossom. I hope to see more books written on this topic.
Mm. Well, let me add this. This is my last question, Nick Tabor. We look at your book, and then we look at, like, say, things that are happening around the country, especially in states like Florida. It seems that this is the type of book that I can see some parents saying, well, I just don't want my child reading about the Middle Passage and the description, and I don't think this book is suitable for my child. Do you see that perhaps happening, that people don't want to hear these stories?
I'm sure that, you know, anybody who's wanting to keep Black history out of, you know, like the people who think that AP African American history course should be purged from their schools are probably not going to like this either. But, you know, by the same token, I think people who are looking for a concise, definitely a concise introduction to environmental racism, but even in some ways, I think a concise history of, like, the struggle of African Americans in the South, this book, I would like to think it gives it to you in a pretty readable way. So, you know, I hope that the, you know, if it does draw hostility from some people, that by the same token, it will draw interest from others.
Well, I tell you, Nick Tabor, I text my son and daughter and daughter-in-law and son-in-law and say, okay, make sure you read this book. Okay, that was my, you know, put this next to the Easter eggs, you know, whatever.
Oh, good.
But
good.
Make
I'm
sure
so
you get this
that.
Book, Nick. I'm happy that I was able to interview you this morning. I think what you've done is remarkable in terms of your research and you know, just putting everything in, making sense out of something that I think is very important, and using your skill as a journalist to really bring things to light. And so I want to thank you for being on the margin.
Thank you. You know, I always spend telling people at some events, like, I know the research is good. It, you know, I'm not being arrogant. I know it is. But if you really want to get on my good side, like, tell me that the writing is good.
Okay, really, well, the writing's really good. Okay. My guest this morning has been Nick Tabor. We've been talking about his new book, Africa Town, America's Last Slave Ship and the Community It Created. The show's On the Margin. My name is Brett Miller. The station is WPFW 89.3 FM.
The best in live music entertainment is coming this spring to Bethesda Theater. Let's welcome music royalty, The Whispers, performing all their classic songs for two big shows on Friday, April 26th at 8:30 p.m. and again on Saturday, April 27th at 8 p.m. Also coming is Trouble Funk, featuring go-go legend Big Tony, celebrating his birthday by performing all their go-go classics on Friday, May 3rd at 9 p.m. And on Mother's Day, it's Howard Hewitt performing his own popular songs and those by Shalimar. But two shows on Sunday, May 12th at 3 p.m. and 7 p.m. The Whispers on April 26th and 27th. Trouble Funk featuring Big Tony on May 3rd. And Howard Hewitt on Mother's Day, May 12th. Get more information on all shows at BethesdaTheater.com. WPFW is a proud media partner with Bethesda Theater.
I'm Candy Shannon, host of Morning Brew, the Friday edition, from 5 to 8 a.m. on member-supported WPFW Washington, 89.3 FM.
WPFW is looking for a new place to hang our hats and microphones. and we're betting that members of WPFW's In the Know listening community, folks like you, may know of spaces where we might make our new home. Have you walked past or know of a cool space that appears to be for lease? Hip us to it. Know of something that's not yet on the market? We're all ears. Your station for Jazz and Justice requires 2,200 square feet of space in Washington, D.C. or immediate environs. Metro accessible with nearby parking. We value your suggestions and observations as we embark on this vital mission. Email your tips to wpfw.lsb.relocation@gmail.com. And thanks for all you do to nourish and sustain WPFW, building a better world one broadcast at a time.
You'd be so nice to come home to. You'd be so nice. Bye.
Dr. Theodore Watkins, the program is to your health.
Join Dr. Theodore Watkins on Mondays from 2 p.m. to 3 p.m. on To Your Health, as he teaches alternative medicine to alleviate illnesses using a holistic approach, bringing important wellness treatment options to the table otherwise overlooked by health officials across a variety of medical fields. Learn how to treat yourself to your best health under the instruction of Dr. Watkins. That's 2 to 3 p.m. on WPFW 89.3 FM, serving the collective need and imagination of the community.
We'll see you again next week.
Welcome to On the Margin with E. Ethelbert Miller. In the studio this morning is Mark Eisner, Meredith M. Taylor, Calvin Reed, Michon Boston, Todd Stephen Burroughs, Chanda Buchanan.
Ethelbert Miller brings you On the Margin, Thursdays at 9 a.m., with personal, compelling interviews with local, national, and international authors of all backgrounds. To cite a few, screenplay writers, independent researchers, news editors, playwriters, poets, and contemporary novelists of nonfiction, fiction, comedy, historical biographies, and even graphic novels and comics. If you listen to What's Behind the Lines, you'll find yourself on the margin with Ethelbert Miller. Thursdays at 9 a.m. Catch the past episodes on our website, WPFWFM.org, and on iTunes and Google Play Music. On your station for Jazz and Justice, WPFW Washington.
This is Rev Yearwood, and I am so excited to announce our new climate show, Think 100% Climate Friday. This show will keep you up to date on everything climate justice related in a rapidly changing world. We will discuss breaking news and updates on environmental issues, the climate crisis, COVID-19, and politics. This show will make tangible how the climate crisis is already impacting our lives and what you can do about it. So tune in every Friday at 9 o'clock a.m. right here on WPFW 89.3, your Jazz and Justice station.
Hi. This is Miyuki Williams, recently appointed Interim General Manager. I want to thank each and every one of you who supported WPFW during our recent relocation drive. You are the fuel that keeps us going. We appreciate your generosity and the collaboration of building a better world one broadcast at a time. Please know we all love you madly.
Still, it's a real good bet. Best is yet to come.
Hi, this is Robin Holden, the proprietor of Robin's Place. Every Friday evening from 7 until 10 p.m., Robin's Place is a mythical entertainment center consisting of four floors. On each floor of Robin's Place, we have rooms that are named after people who I think are icons in music, theater, and literature. We have the Nancy Wilson Room, the Joe Williams Room, the Gloria Lynn Room, the Frank Sinatra Room, the B.B. King Blues Room, the James Baldwin Library, just to name a few. Join me Friday nights from 7 until 10 p.m. as I take you on a musical journey you'll never forget. Robin's Place.
Come the day you're mine, I'm going to teach you to fly.
Economic, political, and military decisions in Washington, D.C. impact this entire country and world. And yet corporate media offers few facts, history, or people's voices about these important issues impacting our lives. I'm Esther Ivarum. Welcome to On the Ground, Voices of Resistance from the Nation's Capital, here on WPFW 89.3, Fridays at 10 a.m. We cover local, national, and international social justice activism, including those who come to D.C. from